how can you generate not just one concept, but many concepts? And how do you avoid getting locked into a current mindset? How do you overcome the biases, cognitive biases? And there are a number of learning approaches associated. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we have Tom Toner, who's joining us for the first time here. We'll see him again a couple more lectures during our time together. Now, I'll let him introduce himself. But first, are there any questions about what we've covered so far, or more specifically, questions about OS3 that haven't been clarified, they're still kind of cloudy in your mind, and you'd just like to get a little bit more feedback and guidance on? Usually, I'm automatically enrolled at the office, so questions just start showing up in my mailbox. And that didn't happen this year, so I was a little bit late to the cause, but I'd like to clarify. Any questions, group, individual assignments? Yeah, Tom?
I know I asked not the other. Can you talk to the, I've thought about it more and I'm still struggling with the scenario.
Yeah, so the scenario really should address the system level behavior. And a system will encounter multiple scenarios. There could be the kind of normal day or normal operations scenario. There's the degraded operations or missing input scenario. There's a scenario where a system might be down for maintenance. There's a scenario where you have maybe a surge of demand from the system. You know, so those are scenarios that help you to really flesh out the requirements and capabilities and capacity that you need to plan for in the system. So you want to exercise it through a number of those different conditions. Now, specific use cases, the way I'm approaching this is looking at really kind of user experience. What does the user encounter in their interaction with the system? That can be different from the overall system conditions and operations. But the user interactions and use cases also contribute requirements. They say, well, we need the capability to do this, perform this function. And so they are contributing to the overall set of functions that you've identified for the system and capabilities. They're just at a kind of a lower level of detail.
Should still be somewhat solution neutral though, if you're still trying to understand the solution space?
Ideally, yes. It's as you start thinking about the functions of the system, you can try to stay solution neutral as long as possible, because you want to preserve the trade space. But at some point, you're going to be drawn into solutions. Pretty quickly. There was a question over here. Was it you want?
Sorry, I can ask a question. My question, could you like lay out for us, it's kind of confusing. There's a bunch of different similar charts for like needs analysis and operational analysis, and then there's the system lifecycle model. Like, how can you give us like a broad overview of how this process goes, kind of the major steps in that?
Good question. So major steps. The life cycle process, SE life cycle process that is outlined in the book readings, is a recurring analysis activity. You start with identifying a need and then with verifying that. And that could happen at the system level, it could happen as you go through the decomposition to different levels of hierarchy. We talked about PDPs, and that gives you a sense of, you know, where do we start this process? And usually it's understanding the user needs, progressing through understanding how the needs are manifested in operations of the system, and activities, behaviors. From those, you can then derive functions or capabilities that are needed or implied by those operations. And from those functions, then, you know, that's part of what we're going to talk about today. You can then say, okay, what function, with these functions or capabilities, what are the concepts that perform those functions or capabilities? So we're marching through on a fairly linear process. Of course, there's always going to be some recursion and iteration. You can circle back and say, okay, well, I just learned a new piece of information, so I have to go back and update some of the assumptions that I made previously, and that might affect the direction that we go in. But we're the way we're discussing it is a fairly linear progression.
If I can have one follow-up on that, where does the decomposition process typically happen? Is that like a needs analysis thing, or is that more of a concept exploration thing slash definition thing, or where can it happen anywhere, or is there a place where it typically happens?
So in system architecting, you look at higher-level functions and then supporting functions that help you accomplish. But generally speaking, if you have a function that's defined that you can't accomplish by itself, or it's a pretty high level, then you tend to decompose that into subordinate functions. And even those might be decomposed into subordinate functions. Needs, you can look at needs overall. You might press a user or whatever source of information you need to access to clarify a need, and maybe that need could be decomposed into sub-needs. But generally, we start the decomposition when we start talking about the architecture of the system. So you're thinking about functions. Well, online question?
Yes. So when we talk about the goals, we have been, last lecture, we talked about goal as a non-mandatory or voluntary requirement as part of the requirement generation. And then we also see goal in line with the SPS or the mission statement. So I just wanted to understand the clarity where and in what context should be using the goals term.
So if I understand your question, we talked about SPS and mission statements, and then we also talked about requirements. And so the mission statement or the SBS is, you know, this is the rationale for why the system exists. This is what it exists to do. As you go through the analysis of the architecture and you start decomposing that purpose of the system into specific functions and capabilities, then you can then assign requirements to those functions and capabilities. Some of those functions are desirable, and some of those functions are necessary to accomplish the objectives of the system. And that's why some requirements would be desirable and others would be mandatory. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Though in the system architecture, when we were developing the requirement, we were told like, shall be and like must shall and will. And now here we have shall, will, and goal. So just trying to avoid a confusion from must, shall, will to shall, will, and goal.
Right, and the wording will vary from organization and context to context. So just be aware that there are things that are easily traded and things that are not easily traded, and sometimes with constraints that you can't trade. And so it's how much flexibility do you have in meeting that requirement or maybe trading that requirement for some other capability? I think there was a question here in the chat.
Thank you. On question two of the OS, it says specify the stakeholder and then do a input-output type of analysis that would kind of frame the need. But it says your potential output that would meet our needs, plural, and then our potential output that would meet their needs, plural as well.
Yeah.
Within one stakeholder, and then we need to write the degree which can meet singular is met. So we need to do, for example, one stakeholder could have many needs.
Yep.
And we can basically evaluate each.
just evaluate them as that package or?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In if this were your job and you were trying to win a new client, you would probably want to do a thorough evaluation of all the needs and how those are being met. In OS3, you have how much space? One page. So you're going to have to consolidate. You have to aggregate in your response. And so that's just part of it, being a school assignment.
And just a quick follow-up. So this table covers the needs analysis, but it doesn't cover, like, for example, we're not explicitly mentioning each stakeholder and their explicit needs. We're just framing it in the form of, like, what do you call it, the context of output and value exchange. So just due to the space, I don't think we have enough space to just explicitly mention the needs for each stakeholder.
Well, you could be creative. I mean, it has to be readable, so you can't use 0.5 font, but. They're be creative in how you present the information. Because you know the follow-on is really to identify if you've got some needs, let's talk about some capabilities that would satisfy those needs. And so your follow-on responses are gonna really depend on how you present those needs and articulate them. Okay, so what I would like to do is introduce you to Tom Toner. Tom, how long have we known each other? Six, five?
I've known him 5 years.
Something like that.
That's right.
Yeah, so Tom he'll introduce himself, but he's been a great addition to the discussion because of his experience. He'll tell you about that.
So good morning. It's always very exciting to be introduced to a new group. And part of what I bring to what I add to the program is I was in your shoes 26 years ago in the first full class of STM. And it's changed, it's improved a lot over the years.
Do you mind moving your microphone to your shirt instead of your sweater?
Not at all. I mean, if that's.
So much better.
Okay, great, thanks. So things have changed a lot, but a lot of the fundamentals and what makes the program so great were there even 25 years ago. And like many of you, I was at Sikorsky Aircraft working on a new system as I was going through the program. So that was also a way to think about, okay, here are all these new ideas. I'm in the middle of this program. How can I use these? And it becomes very practical to sort through the ideas and think, you know, for given issues you have in front of you, how would you use these practices to assist? So I started it at Sikorsky on an Army program, moved to civil aircraft. I'll talk a little bit more about those. And it was on a civil program that I was able to apply a lot of the SDM techniques to that aircraft. And from Sikorsky, I moved to Applied Materials in Silicon Valley. Applied Materials kind of grew up side by side with Intel. They provide the equipment that's used to manufacture chips, and along with a number of other companies, but they're kind of the number one semi-equipment supplier. And one thing that was real interesting about going from aerospace to semi-equipment, and semi-equipment is like super technical, incredibly technical, but it's also like the Wild West in terms of their processes. So they were recruiting people with a system engineering background from aerospace to come in and say, you know, maybe our processes aren't that great. How can you help us, be more structured in how we do things? So that was another great experience because there you have to think, okay, I better come up with some techniques that are going to be well received, right, and really make an impact so that people understand there's real benefit here, and then you can build on that and be able to introduce more complex stuff. But if you roll out the fancy stuff too quickly, then you can get a lot of pushback and it's hard to show results. So that was a real interesting challenge. I worked at some other semi-equipment companies after that. And very, very interested culture at these companies. And then in addition to that, I worked at a flexible solar company, and also most recently at a storage. So what I'll try to do as I jump into these lectures from time to time is add some practical examples of things that I've experienced and how that applies to the things that you're learning. And hopefully also it's like boots on the ground experience. So if you're thinking, wow, this is a great theory, how do I apply it? Hopefully I can help answer some of those.
I found this on the web.
Sorry, now it's Siri picking up your prompting.
That means my mic's working well. Siri's here. So on to the specific example. So like I said, the first aircraft I worked on with a full blank sheet of paper design was the Comanche, as you see here. First of a kind stealth aircraft. We did it as a joint venture with Boeing, and again, incredibly technical aircraft, low observables, whether it was radar or acoustics, all composite fuscelage, all sorts of major advances for the Army. And the fun thing about these DoD programs is the Army likes to keep adding new stuff. And so as we were designing the aircraft and building it and flying the aircraft, we were constantly fielding input for, can we add this system, that system. And so after 30 years of that, it became sort of unwieldy. I think I had left the program by the time it was canceled, but it speaks to the benefit of not allowing programs to have requirements creep and drag out and get aircraft built flying before you're exposed to too many different presidential administrations, I think. 30 years, that's how many, five, six. In the middle of working on Comanche, we also started up at Sikorsky a new company-funded civil aircraft program, and it was sort of, we had built the aircraft that it was S-61. You see it as actually even the current presidential aircraft that you'll see, President Biden walk out of. That was designed and developed back in the 60s, and so long in the tooth, and so we felt strategically as a company that we needed a replacement for that aircraft. And so we came up with this self-funded program. In order to make it more affordable, we designed it as an international partnership. So we had five international partners, Japan, Spain, Taiwan, Brazil, and mainland China, each built sections of the aircraft. And so we did early design, what we call basic data, and we handed that off to the partners, and they did their own detailed design and fabrication. So that had a whole different set of challenges, and that was the program I was working on. I went through SDM. I was in the role of chief system engineer, so at Sikorsky, that role is you're responsible for all the technical attributes of the aircraft and making sure that those attributes are delivered in the product. And last I checked, we had over 300 of these sold. Many of them fly this mission, which is taking oil workers out to offshore oil rigs in bad climates like the North Sea between Scotland and Norway. But also they fly VIP missions. We've sold search and rescue aircraft to Canada and other entities, so it's been pretty successful, and it's a very safe aircraft, which we're proud of, and also it's been very effective in a search and rescue role, which feels good because you're safe, saving people's lives and stuff like that. So it's that, very satisfying compared with the Army program. So, has some different needs. From there, like I said, I went to Silicon Valley, working at First Applied Materials, and then actually Varian Semiconductor is a company here in Gloucester that makes the system you see on the lower left. And just for scale, that's the size of a Amazon delivery truck or something. But these systems get quite large and complex. Many different subsystems delivering the processes to the wafers to form the features on the chip that in these cases were really the transistor steps. So the most technically challenging steps in chip production are right at the transistor level because that's where the features are the smallest. And so jumping into that environment and introducing techniques that I brought from MIT and from Sikorsky and sitting with the CEO of Applied Materials and reviewing some success we had on the system on the right, bringing that to market and having it done in a way that was very smooth process. Why are you so confident that these things are going to work? And it's really the experience I had at Sikorsky and with MIT to know these processes really do work. And if you make the investment in these things up front, you're going to have a very smooth transition of your product into manufacturing. And that was where they really stumbled. They always had problems with that transition. So that was great. I worked on a bunch of new systems. There's new technologies. That transistor step was changing rapidly at that time. So there were many new technologies. We had a laser annealing tool that basically swept the surface of the laser out of the chip with a laser to anneal the implants that were put there by the ion implant tool. So really crazy stuff. And I think a real test of the processes that are at the heart of. And then the last experience I had in semiconductor equipment was with ASML. I don't know how many of you have heard of ASML or this particular system. It tends to get mentioned a lot because of the comment on the lower left, which there are people who will say, and you know, it's arguable, but some people will say that this is one of the most complex systems ever designed and built. And it's what has kept Moore's Law alive going into the 2020s, allowing incredibly small features now down to like 2 nanometers on a chip to be produced. And this is the critical step. This is printing the features on the surface of the wafer so that the machines I showed you in the prior slide would be able to do their steps. So everything is driven by this lithography step, and without it, really progress on Moore's Law would slow dramatically, if not stop. But you can see the scale of the system. This is just what's in the fab, which is on the first level. There's 3 times that much equipment on the level below, supporting just this main piece that's on the fab level. The wafers go in and out of the process. So this is just it was an incredible process. ASML actually very good in system engineering practices. They're a Dutch company, and they did some really impressive things, but it was all needed to make this work. It was really pushing the limits of fundamental physics. So I can stop there for a second if you have any questions, or else I can just add a few slides on constant generation. If you
good.
Everybody online?
Good.
Yeah.
Was your role at all these semiconductor companies similar, a systems engineer, or were you in these various roles?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it did vary. Initially, at Sikorsky, I was had the technical background, so I really led the technical activities applied materials, as I mentioned, it's an incredibly technical business. So there's fundamental physics and chemistry happening on the surface of the wafer. That's what makes these things work. And I was not, I did not have that, you know, deep technical background. So I moved a little bit more on the program management side. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of SA, now we're in SE, and later in the fall, you'll get introduction to program management from Brian. And it was more in that role at Applied Materials initially, where I was running these programs, thermal annealing or actually ion implant. I was running those programs, but there were people that were responsible for the real technical part of it. What I was able to do, though, is bring some of these broad concepts in and say, okay, we're in this phase of a program. Here's what we need to be doing. And in many of these companies, they don't do those things. So it's kind of obvious. Like, you're looking around, you call a meeting, okay, let's do some concept generation. I'll give you an example later today. And nobody has a clue, you know, how to do it, basically. It's whatever the smartest guy thinks, you know. So it's kind of bringing that kind of understanding in. But I think it should give quite a bit of confidence to you in that you can go to different environments. And yeah, if you're not, you're rarely going to be the deep technical expert on a system. So you need to be bringing in these other techniques in order to augment what is that deep technical understanding. And I even got into operational roles. So one of the lectures I'll do later this fall is on operations for system engineers. Now, in these companies, if you're in an operations role, it's still super technical. So kind of move around a little bit where it's most needed. At this company, it was more operational and program management.
Thank you.
Okay. One more question? Yeah.
Just kind of out of curiosity, yeah. You mentioned on one of the past helicopters, you were most proud that it was a search and rescue type of helicopter. I'm curious, was that one of the primary goals or functions you were trying to accomplish with that helicopter?
Okay.
Or did it come about because of...
There's a neat quote from Igor Sikorsky, who founded the company and invented this style helicopter that Sikorsky made, airplanes can fly over someone who needs to be rescued and drop flowers, but a helicopter can actually go and rescue them. And that was really, he had that in mind. He was quite an interesting guy and humanitarian. And so it was only later that people got clever and realized you could hang missiles and machine guns on helicopters and have them perform those kind of missions. The search and rescue mission at Sikorsky is kind of, it's one of the favorites that people really like to make sure that that's something that the aircraft are capable of. All right. So just very quickly on concept generation background, Eric has a lot more material. But the thing that, from a practical standpoint, there's a real basic reason why it's really important to do your concept generation well and thoroughly in the early phases of the PDP. And that is that you've got freedom in the early stages to make changes, to consider, more different architectures even, in addition to even different subsystems that are part of your overall system. So in order to do the concept generation well, it's really important to do that really broadly and thoroughly. And make sure that you're bringing in a real cross-functional group to help with the idea generation, because you'd be really surprised where good ideas come from sometimes. It's not always the people that you expect to give you a good idea, or there can be an idea that triggers other ideas where people pile on, and that's a really, really useful approach, particularly when you're, again, pushing the envelope of this is something really new, and how are we really going to get this done in a way that's going to hold up over time? Because you're going to make commitments about the architecture of the system early, and you really like for those to hold. You don't want to be going back and changing those later on. So the approaches that Eric will talk about are very helpful to inform this kind of a process. And one thing you'll find is that in early stages of a program, you're going to have a lot of senior folks on the program. So, you know, people that have had the most experience understand their systems and subsystems and various technical expertise the best. And so it's real important to work through with those folks to say, hey, let's really be open-minded here. Let's not try to just collapse on the way we've always done it, which is most familiar. And sometimes it seems like the easiest approach, but not certainly the best. So, and of course, if you don't have a great idea, don't go ahead. Keep working it to make sure that you've got something that's really effective. Obviously, you're going to do patent searches and things like that to make sure you understand the competitive landscape. And this slide is really, you've seen it before, and it's really something that is a motivation for the PEP and for some of these rules of when to do concept generation, things like that. It really comes down to this idea of committed cost. It's committed to a lot of things, but as you're working on complex systems, as you're locking in the design, you're also locking in a big portion of not only the development cost, but the recurrent cost of the system. And so it's really important, again, to get that right, and obviously ease of change is coming down over time. You can see the phases down here at the bottom, so this is kind of a rough breakdown of concept and preliminary design and detailed design. But really, by late in this concept phase, you probably have a lot of the architecture of the system worked out. And so if you're going down the path with a concept that has issues, and I'll give you an example later of one that had issues, it's really important to straighten that out as soon as you can. So that as you're ramping up your program, bringing lots of resources on, bringing suppliers on, possibly funding some early development of subsystems, things of that nature, you're really headed down the path with the best possible system. And so here's an example of an approach, and Eric's going to cover a number of additional examples, but this is one I'll come back to at the end of the lecture. And this is the Pew concept matrix. And here it says concept selection, and you can use it for concept selection, but the thing that is helpful, and maybe just to explain it for first, you're gonna have the attributes of your system, the things you care about, the requirements for the system are gonna be on the left of the matrix. And then you're gonna list, you know, different options that you think of. And you're going to have one of the options, usually the incumbent technology for that requirement, is going to be a baseline. So the baseline gets zero as a score. And then from there, you sort of think of, okay, you know, in this case, it's long launch, right? So how many different approaches could I take? And then with a group, with a cross-functional group, you score. You know, which is a hand mower better than a gas mower? I'm not sure what the difference is there. In purchase costs. Clearly, the robotic mower is going to cost more, so that gets minus one. And you go down these attributes, and you do a quick scoring. It's kind of a rough way to attribute some of these different options. But the key for concept generation is, all right, I see these different options, and I see what I like and I don't like about each of the options. And as a group, you take a conscious exercise and approach to say, if I take the things that I like about a hand mower and combine them with what I like about a cordless electric mower, can I come up with a new concept that's a better one? Maybe not all the attributes, but more of attributes, that it's a superior concept that I want to go forward with. And so this the title of the slide is concept selection. What I'm emphasizing here is you can use this for concept generation and come up with new ideas with your team to develop new concepts, and I'll show an example of how we did this at Sikorsky later in the lecture. But you wouldn't necessarily use this to finally down select in your concept. Eric will show you some trade study concepts that are much more sophisticated than this, but it is helpful to generate some ideas. So, any questions there? Very simple and practical. You know, so I think you'll find that if you're in a team and it's a fast-moving team, approaches like this are helpful. Yeah, sure.
The challenge I find with tools like this and working with fellow engineers is that everyone gets very focused on numbers and weight, what people want to weight, prioritize, and is a plus one there 100% better than the minus one on the other side?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And I don't know, do you have any experience in trying to stop that happening? Because I think that would lose the value of tools.
I mean, it's fair in one sense, right? I mean, not every plus one is the same, right? So, you know, it's okay. But no, it's important to bring the team back to, we're not using this to make a final decision. We're not going to rule everything out either at this stage, right? So if people are kind of, you know, you get people trying to put a thumb, you know, on the scale a little bit, right? You know, I have my favorite, so I'm going to help this one along. So you have to just try to diffuse that with, you know, we're early, and let's get some ideas out. We're going to do a much more thorough evaluation a month or two from now. To really down select, and you know, try to keep people focused on that bigger issue. And you know, people respond to that. I don't think you know, I don't think it can get derailed too quickly. And but I'll show you the example I have. I'll show you how I put my finger on the scale too. So when you're a system engineer, sometimes you can find better ways to do that. Any other questions?
Okay, yeah, so, thank you, Tom. So we'll talk about this more on Wednesday.
Your mic's not on.
Well, I'll just turn it on then. thank you, Ryan. So we'll talk more about this on Wednesday in the lecture called Concepts Lecture. Okay, so concepts are a key part of architecture definition. This is what you were told in SA is true. And you may have remembered the statement, managing and focusing creativity to create concept is the main role of the architect during the architecting process. And here's some slides from both Ed and Bruce. So we have the concept is this here, and we have the solution neutral processes, and we have this system operations and operands, and you have generic concept forming and the specific concept form. Or, you know, more simply, you're going from function to form in concept. And there are lots of inputs. So, very simple, right? Function to form, get a concept, it's your main deliverable as architect. Okay? So how do you create it? Does it just magically appear? How do you create concepts? We've heard from Tom about concept generation. I want to hear from you. How do you create concepts to perform this key architecting function? Yes?
Brainstorming,
okay. So what does brainstorming do for you? So each person comes up with one or two concepts, and at the end you have a bunch of concepts. Okay, what else? Dax.
Yeah, going and talking to the end user and asking them, hey, what is it that you need to solve your problem, and trying to get ideas from them.
And do they provide concepts as in solutions?
It is in my space because it's pretty well defined. If it was less defined, I could see that being less useful.
So you could, in your space, you could skip the architecting process and just go ask the user what they want. pipeline.
To an extent, yeah.
To an extent, yeah. Okay. Hero.
It's kind of the same concept tasks, but I'd say market cultivation. So it's the protocol. I just go to the actual place, user use the car. They try to find out how they use the car. They try to find out their needs. Then the concept is coming up from the engineers.
Okay. So you understand the need, and I don't know if it's still the same way at Toyota now as it is when you read Jeff Leiker's books, but the chief engineer spends a year with the users and really understands the needs and use cases and operating scenarios and then develops a concept. Okay, so needs and then a concept emerges somehow. Okay, BJ, online.
Yeah, so we could list down what are the different ways by which a function could be achieved. So there could be multiple forms and maybe a combination of those forms would give us kind of a solution, and we can cross-check whether the solution or the concept is meeting the needs or not.
Yeah, okay.
So thinking about the system in terms of a job to be done, like what job is the system intended to accomplish,
Yep. And
translating that into capabilities. So like thinking about the needs as capabilities and what are different ways that you can deliver those capabilities.
Okay, so that's maybe a bit more systematic approach to mapping function to form. And what you're doing is you're identifying multiple forms that could satisfy the function in common, and then you can make combinations. Okay? Mo?
We could look at products that already exist, similar to like the helicopter example. There's a search and rescue helicopter that someone thought you can add weapons to the helicopter. That would be another concept of how you use that existing vehicle.
Yeah. Okay. Abe, how do you generate concepts? I think we lost Abe. Jordan, you back?
Yeah, sorry about that. I'm having internet issues. So I work for the same employer Dax works for, and as you just mentioned, it's not the best way. So Dax works on our current systems, and that's how the complex has operated for the last 17 years. We are trying to change that with the future systems. So we use combination of system engineering and enterprise architecture framework to generate the best viable concepts. And get an approval from customers. So we are trying to change that process
Okay. And
make it more efficient.
Yeah, and Jordan, last, how do you? You don't work for the same places.
No, I'm a dear guy. TradeSpace. I don't know if that's maybe jumping too far ahead, but TradeSpaces are an interesting way, I think, to generate some maybe not intuitive concepts.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in much more detail on Wednesday. Okay, so yeah, all of you have kind of identified the ways that concepts are typically generated. You have an existing product, you evolve it. You get feedback from the market group or from the user directly, and they say, well, I'd really like you to have this function or like more of this or less of that. And so you have a product update, all right? And that's pretty straightforward because you're really constrained by your existing architecture, maybe your existing product realization process, existing supply chain, and you're just making small improvements. Maybe you are looking at something that somebody else is doing. So, an example, Agile software development. Right? Software people are using Agile Scrum method. It seems to be really great. Let's try it in our product development process for creating homes. We'll do Agile, right? And so, and that's the way these things, sometimes called fads, kind of proliferate. You know, you have a popular activity or product or approach in one area, and you apply it in another area. Sometimes if you are in an industry that has a pretty large footprint and a lot of members, you might have industry associations, and sometimes those associations create roadmaps. This is where we're going to be in 10 years, and 20 years, and 30 years, and there are consultants who, Gartner and IDC also, you know, generate these roadmaps that say, and McKinsey, and, you know, there are lots of them. And so for, like, autonomous vehicles, they'll say, oh, well, and by 2035, we'll have level 4 autonomy, and so forth. And so these are the technologies that you need to be aware of. Lead users, anyone familiar with that concept? Eric von Hippolyte-Sloan, you know, many years ago in the innovation group, came up with this concept that, or identified the fact that there, for any given product, especially technical products that are being used by engineers, they tend to take them apart and modify them and make them better or better serve their own purposes. And those are called lead users because they're innovating the product in their operations. And if you can tap into those lead users, you can find out new applications, maybe new adaptations or combinations with other types of processes and products. And that can be a source of new concepts. Sometimes you're going to be integrating existing elements into a new idea. So back with the iPhone, we had cellular phones. We had personal digital assistants. What were those things called? PDAs? The Palm Pilot? And Steve Jobs said, well, what if we combine all of those functions together into a phone? And people said, oh, you're crazy. Nobody will ever buy that. And they did. Turns out. So you can think of combinations of existing functions that are enabled by technology. So the advance of semiconductor processing, increasing power of chips, increasing batteries, efficiency or storage capacity per unit volume or weight, enabled you to put those functions together into one unit. And sometimes you have new concepts that are enabled because you have a new technology. Right? A new technology comes out that is going to make something now possible that was previously not possible or feasible, at least. And finally, have new entrants. Okay, so a lot of different places you can get concepts from. And again, we tend to think about, let's think of the solution. What is a concept solution that will solve a problem? But you know, if you go back to the spirit of what you've been learning so far, the question is there a systematic process that you can use to go from identified needs to functions, to abilities, to then all of a sudden many different ideas about concepts that could satisfy those needs we've identified. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Okay, so this is from the assigned reading from Ulrich and Eppinger. This is their design process. So first, you clarify the problem, you compose it into functions. You're all really familiar with that by now. You're probably sick of it. But you know, you heard about defining the functions to be performed by the system in SA. Okay. Next, in their process, there's the search process. Okay, and this is where you search for, you search externally, so you look at what other people are doing, you look for users, you look for information outside of your group. And the value of having them outside of your group is people are outside of your group or organization are unconstrained by your vision of how things work and how problems are solved. And so this is a real opportunity to develop creativity. Internally, if you want to stimulate creativity, then you engage in ideation processes or other things that we'll talk about shortly when we talk about creativity. Right? But this is this is a way of kind of opening the aperture to new ideas about how you move from those functions you've identified into forms. So one of the challenges that we have to overcome is our cognitive biases. So we learned earlier about how we're capable of handling 7 ± 2 things in terms of how many things can we keep track of. Well, this is another area where understanding how people work, how we think, is helpful. So a cognitive bias is essentially something that forces you into a certain pattern or way of thinking or specific solution sets. And that's a really good thing because it makes your thinking more efficient. So you don't have to solve the same problem over and over again every time you encounter a new stimulus. But what happens is when you have a change in the situation, the same old solution doesn't necessarily work. Right? And in fact, you can have a psychological discomfort. Right? You're uncomfortable with the ambiguity and you want an easy solution. And so one way is to fall back on familiar patterns, things that you know will work, at least in a different context. And there are a lot of different cognitive biases. Let's pick one, confirmation bias. Anybody familiar with confirmation bias? Okay, yeah, Tim?
Agree with information that confirms their existing beliefs.
Exactly. So you agree with information and not only agree with, but you tend to filter information that doesn't confirm your existing beliefs. And that's the challenge. So that's how you get stuck in problems. Some dramatic and tragic examples of confirmation bias were the space shuttle accidents. So in 1986, the Challenger mission was lost when hot gas in the solid rocket booster leaked past an O-ring and caused a catastrophic failure. Well, it turns out that they had a lot of evidence to say that if you launched these boosters in cold temperatures, that they became inflexible and their ability to seal was compromised. And people said, well, you know, we've been able to do it so far, so it must not be a big deal. And it wasn't until they had the accident investigation that, you know, Richard finally showed them that these things deform and they don't spring back when they're cold. And that's how you get the pathway that caused this accident. And it was similar with the Columbia accident investigation. They had ice coming off the external tank on many launches, and they thought, well, you know, we got away with it, so that's fine, and didn't look at the evidence that had accumulated to show what kind of damage that falling ice could do. And it's not until they actually got the tests that showed that it can punch a hole in the reinforced composite heat shield that they realized, oh, it wasn't the way we thought it was. So confirmation bias can have huge impacts when you start filtering out information that might be helpful. What else? The confirmation bias, gambler's fallacy. The safer things are, the more risks we can take. But the safer we perceive things, the more risks we can take. If something we perceive as risky, then we should pull back. But again, that's your perception of the risk. You don't know if you should be handling that risk in the same way in both cases. Bandwagon effect. Anybody work where there's a bandwagon effect in play? This is where everyone kind of rallies around a common solution and starts, you know, they start kind of mutually reinforcing their perception of whether that solution is the right solution. Online question?
No, I was just saying that I work in the space, so I work in software, and working in Nigeria, one of the things that happened was the recent fintech boom with startups like Spotify and Paystack, and then we automatically just saw like a 300% increase in the number of fintech startups in Nigeria. So like I was just agreeing to the ongoing effect.
Yeah. So the effect here with cognitive biases is you tend to limit the number of options that you consider. And there are a lot of reasons why. Those are all of these different biases. And if you want to really get into this, you can look at Kahneman and diversity and thinking fast and slow. And there are lots of fascinating ways that, you know, our humanity kind of undermines our rational engineering view of the world. But the practical effect is that we tend to restrict the number of things that we're willing to consider. Right? And when we think about concepts of generation, and what we've been talking about so far is as we go from function to form, we want to have as many possible options available as we can. Morgan.
I'd really like to hear your thoughts on this. I hear this happen all the time, especially like root cause analysis stuff, or like, oh, there's a cognitive bias, that's why they did what they did. But it's impossible to explore every option, right? So we need to use our heuristics of cognitive biases to limit us to some space. And it's impossible, or very difficult at very least, to know beforehand how to limit ourselves, right? And so it's very easy to say afterwards, oh, we have cognitive biases, we shouldn't have limited ourselves. But the question is always, how do we know to what extent we should have limited ourselves, right? We can't explore every option, and so we need to use these cognitive biases in some sense to limit ourselves. How do you strike that balance?
Yeah, so typically you the way brain, I think somebody trademarked copyright brainstorming, so I don't know if we can use it or not, but the way people typically do brainstorming is you have a creative phase where any answer is okay. Mm-hmm. And so you get some crazy, you know, wild ideas, hopefully. And then you have a phase where you evaluate them more or less, you know, is this really serious? But there are a number of approaches I'm going to show you shortly that force you to, in a systematic way, force you to look at different approaches or ways of thinking about moving from function to form. And in that structured fashion, then you can identify potentially good ideas, right? So I'll finish on this slide and then we'll take a break, which means I now no longer have your attention. There are some ways that you can force yourself to overcome these cognitive biases. First of all, you can look at multiple options. And the easiest way to do it is to look at what's the most likely option that we might pursue, what is the least likely, and what is the worst case. And you can look at what is the most likely thing that we're going to do, the baseline. So you force yourself into moving outside of what you think you're going to do into extremes. And that can generate some creativity. You can question the assumptions and say, okay, what are the assumptions that we've made as we've identified these forms that satisfy the requirements? What if we change those assumptions? What if we throw them out? What if we do something that is the opposite? Prospective hindsight, predictive future failure, our system's going to fail, and you can just and imagine different ways it would fail and work your way back. Say, okay, what is it about these features that might cause this failure? Outside view, consider objectives, evaluating options jointly. So you look at multiple options and you then, Tom alluded to this when he talked about the huge selection matrix. Sometimes there are parts of many things that you like, and what would happen if you combine them together? You could eliminate your preferred option and say, okay, if that's closed off to us, and sometimes it is because of IP issues, where you have a path that you'd like to take and somebody else is already locked in, in that area, then you have to identify a different option. And then, of course, you don't want to keep going on forever, as you just asked, Morgan. So you often will set up a tripwire and say, okay, we're done being creative, and we're going to start doing some engineering. Not that engineering isn't a creative activity. Okay, so I'm going to get into some specifics after this, but let's take a 5-minute break. We'll come back in 5 minutes, and we'll continue the conversation.
We are not
So we ended up different ways to approach creativity, right? And there are three primary ways: combinatorial, exploratory, and transformational creativity. And they are actually reflected in some of these specific methods for overcoming cognitive bias. And if you think you're suffering from any one specific cognitive bias, like this work has been going on for decades. So there's usually, for a specific cognitive bias, there are countermeasures that say, if you suffer from this approach in your team or organization, here are some techniques that you can use to overcome that. All right, and this is kind of a summary of those things. But you can get even more specific. But let's talk about creativity. So combinatorial creativity is bringing things together in new ways to come up with a new outcome. So Steve Jobs was using combinatorial creativity when he thought of the iPhone. Let's bring together these existing parts and something cool will happen, right? Or using an analogy. So let's use agile development in our pick your industry, creating combines. We'll create harvesting machines using agile methods. Exploratory. So for those who read, which I think is an assignment, so all of you should have, right? What came to mind for you when you read about exploratory creativity, constant exploration? So we can have a long conversation about how the AI got to creating that new combination, but essentially we would assume that there are there's a database of a vast number of different moves, and they're searching through combinations and filtering out the ones that didn't make any sense, and what remained was a viable option. And that led to success.
Yeah. But my point was that the move that it played, it was not an obvious move, or any other player would not play that move. So it was kind of a move that was outside of the normal trade space or political space for an analytical
one. Interesting. So, again, a long conversation, but if you look at large language models, it's looking at correlations that exist from vast databases that, or neural networks in this case, combinations and itself correlation between some different data elements that existed within its data set and decided to exercise that. Do you have a question or comment?
No, I was going to mention, as an example for us, we, in Chevron, in our facility, critical facility, typically design engineers or project engineers, they have a format of coming up with the project, pretty much. And one of the things that we did to combine certain processes was to introduce the feedback from construction early on. So we started realizing that especially the early engineers ended up doing whatever the construction team told them to do. So they would design something and then last minute they would just change it because it didn't make sense to do. Mm-hmm. So we introduced a review very, very early on in the design because this was just kind of a lot of feedback. Even though they were not engineers, they knew that it was going to work. Yeah.
Okay, and this explored in what way? How is this exploratory, do you think?
So for me it's exploratory because when you're coming up with the concept with what you want to design, there's different ways that you can approach it, right? And thinking about the end of how it's going to work, something that's hard for an engineer compared to somebody who has experience actually working with things functioning and breaking off.
Yeah, and in this case, it sounds like the catalyst was bringing people with different perspectives into the conversation. Yeah. Gordon?
Yeah, one thing I thought about is kind of this paradoxical relationship between constraints and exploration. So sometimes, like we hear, necessity is the mother of innovation. And sometimes when we're constrained, we explore other processes that we wouldn't have normally explored, and that leads to new innovation. And so sometimes artificially constraining ourselves to help explore different areas can be a good way to explore novel solutions.
Yeah. And that was one of the ways to overcome cognitive biases is rule out the one that you prefer. And that forces you out. And a lot of these techniques I'm going to show you, well, some of them are systematic ways of forcing you to not fall back in normal approaches. Caleb, question or comment?
Well, for exploratory, maybe I was thinking it's like Dolly. Like if you're saying like, oh, I want to see SpongeBob, I don't know, as the Queen of England, or I don't know, and then like it creates something that you wouldn't have thought of before, but within like your own, I don't know.
Yeah. So there's an example to come here shortly. I think maybe the next slide of you can use AI to come up with combinations of ideas that you wouldn't think of because the AI doesn't know any better. It just says, okay, let's merge things. It doesn't do completely random stuff, but it brings together a vast data set of inputs, brings together combinations that we wouldn't have the mental bandwidth to pursue. David, your comment?
Yeah, previous to my current role, spent time in kind of the eVTOL space, and there's this like wheel of eVTOLs, just like all the designs of ways to lift something vertically and fly it. And a lot of companies are kind of pulling out designs that were, you know, maybe thrown away in the 60s because of technology. And so that was like a big exploration phase. And then you added combinations of, okay, with better batteries and electric motors, can we now, this idea that was thrown away in the 60s now can that be real? And so a lot of the, when you look at a lot of the people who are starting to try to bring this or more variety to this space, that's a little bit of that beginning exploration and then moving from exploratory creativity into the combinations and how do you put things together with the technology we have today.
So a great example of bringing a different perspective. In this case, it's a historical perspective, but something they couldn't do back then and we can do now. And a lot of the interesting ideas are really, instead of just a propeller and an airplane and a wing or a helicopter with a giant rotor, you have integration of airframe and propulsion systems that enable a new kind of behavior of enhanced lift or something like that. So again, different ideas. So transformational creativity. Forcing yourself to think of something that could not have been done previously. And so, to some extent, David talked about that, of the impossible becoming possible because a new technology enables it to happen. And this is where we'll get into a little bit later, a conversation about technology roadmapping. Right? So, what would happen if I had technology, if I had a battery with energy storage density that's 10 times better than what we have currently? Okay, what would that enable? That's an example. And you say, okay, well, this is a kind of system that we could create, and here's some other technologies that we create in order to support that system's performance. And so you go down a path. That's a great thing about modeling, is you can make up functions and give them performance attributes that don't currently exist and predict what the future system might look like. So here are the three different types. Kayla mentioned the like DALL-E. There's the Google Deep Dream Generator. These are things that where we're relying on AI, and to some extent AI is naivete, but also a vast understanding of a large, you know, from a large data set of inputs to combine things that we wouldn't normally think of combining. There are other ones. These are all information technology or AI-enabled activities. So for combinations, there's an application that combines natural language and puns. And so this is like the dad joke, you know, generator. What do you do when you cross a shell with a display computer screen? Well, we don't need more dad jokes in the world, but it turns out that people that have cognitive challenges in understanding language and the connection of different parts of language can really benefit from having interaction with this kind of system, because this connects different elements of language together in logical combinations. Right? So that's how you're doing that. And it's, again, combinations, bringing things together that didn't previously, that currently exist but haven't been combined. Exploratory creativity, designing fonts. Font design, you know, we can download fonts for free off the internet. We have unlimited capabilities these days, it seems. But designing an actual font set is a really labor-intensive process. There are certain rules about aesthetics and design that you have to follow, and you have to apply that across the alphabet that you're working with and the punctuation and so forth. Well, Letter Spirit has those rules embedded in them, and you can then give it some inputs to generate a new font set. Okay? So limited inputs, it does the rest of the work. And that's really what we're relying on AI to do for us these days. It has the very large data set. It has a few rules that it's programmed around, and we provide some inputs, and it does most of the work for us. So that's how AI is starting to affect our creativity. For old school, design thinking is really relying on understanding users, engaging with them, bringing those different voices into the discussion in a very social environment. So observation, interviews, interactions, workshops, understanding the problem space, and then rapidly prototyping and showing the users what you've come up with. So the rapid prototyping is, let's brainstorm concepts, let's brainstorm 20 concepts, and we'll let the users tell us what they think about them. And in the process, they say, well, that doesn't work, this doesn't work, I like that part, but I don't like that part. And you can start synthesizing those ideas into a reliable concept. Good for specific applications or tasks, specific form-to-function mapping, kind of hard to scale up for system analysis. Analogous solution concepts, parts libraries, code libraries, model libraries, if you're in a model-based design environment, ways that you can access all of these different approaches and see what has been used in other ways. This is, again, combinatorial creativity approach. This is an example where engineers are next to an area that has a bunch of material stored. And they can go in and wander around and look at materials or parts and see, well, this is something I hadn't thought of before. Maybe we should by designing this. And then there's TRIZ. How many of you have heard of TRIZ? I see one. Our German student. Okay, we have a few. Michael, what is your experience with TRIZ? On
It was a way that was introduced to try to help with concept generation, and kind of the basis, at least the way it was explained to us, was that it kind of goes to what David was talking about earlier, but you start with the knowledge of what the concept is, and you can look at how the natural progression of a system should occur. So something that's got, I don't know, pivots in it, long-term may become a flexible or compliant member, as an example.
So did you actually use TRIDS?
We used it at times to try to understand. I'm trying to remember what the other, there's like nine box or something like that, that was one of the like one up, one out type concepts. And then there's concepts around like how do you use it in the environment and making sure that you look at the next system level up environments when you're designing parts, and we use those concepts.
Okay, good, thank you. Abe, have you used TRIDS before?
Yes, I have. First of all, this is a very good concept generation method, but unfortunately it did not work out for our purposes. So we tried to adapt it, but it was not very productive for us, so we moved away from it.
Yeah.
But it is a good concept generation method.
Yeah, so thank you for your experiences. If you spend any time with the design people, TRIZ will inevitably come up. It started in the Soviet Union based on exploration of literally millions of patents. And the assumption is that there are certain ways that problems get solved. And so it categorized, this is pre-computer, so it, you know, with millions of these patents, it categorized problems and solutions, and you have this matrix. And essentially what TRIZ does is force you to confront the fact that there are different ways to solve problems. So you go from a specific problem to a general problem, and then from the general problem to a general solution, then you go down to a specific solution. And that movement from the general solution to the specific solution is where all these different options come into play. Right? Turns out that TRIZ really hasn't taken off. It's got a lot of potential. Excellent things, but it's very labor intensive. What it does do for you is it is a systematic process that forces you to explore ideas or combinations or functions that you just wouldn't think of. In that regard, it's a forcing function. It helps you to be productive. I'm going to move on. So, for instance, one of the principles is skipping. So, some phases of a process that you go through in a normal sequence are destructive. What if you just skip that process? So, in the example here, we have a high-speed dentist drill. As you drill a material, it tends to heat it up. But if you have high-speed drill, then you remove the material before it has a chance to heat up. Same process applies to high-speed machining. If you want to machine a part, you go through a high-speed process with a lot of power, and it removes the chips so quickly that the part doesn't have a chance to heat up and warp. Right. Blessing in disguise. A lot of you have talked about constraints. So what if you have a process that produces waste heat? Because the second law of thermodynamics, most processes or things that involve energy produce waste heat. Well, so what if you can harness that waste heat to power the device or power something else? All of a sudden it goes from a problem to a resource. Right? That's the kinds of examples when you have these principles. I think there are 40 or so principles in TRIZ that you use to say, okay, if I use this principle of design, how can I get around this cognitive block that I have between wanting to perform a certain function and the form or instantiation that I'm using? So maybe you don't go full in on TRIZ, but there are some benefits that you can get from thinking about how you might impose that structured process. in your own creativity. SE perspective on creativity, for really new groundbreaking systems, you really have to rely on creativity and encourage creativity. And creativity usually thrives when you have space, when you create space for people to think. And you'll have a creativity workshop during IEP, so you get more introduction to that. But creativity usually flourishes in open space or when there's room or resources. And so you have to make room for it in your program plan or your technical plan. I'll talk about this a little bit more, but new technologies emerging from the lab can be key enablers. You as a systems engineer need to monitor those developments and tie into the technology development process so that you can anticipate where those new technologies and those new capabilities will potentially impact your system and your architecture, especially when you're thinking about the N+1, N+2, N+3 system, you know, generation beyond. So one of the big challenges that we have in systems is legacy. If you have a very complex system, a lot of parts you are not in a position to change. And so you, those are constraints to you. And so there are only so many things you can do to be creative. And it often would be in the form of technology insertion, for instance, to enable new capability. So there's this tension between legacy and new features, and if you have enough of a case to say there's a new way of operating or delivering these functions, then we'll start with a clean sheet design. But that doesn't come up very often. And then we've talked about the systematic, there's morphological matrix. I'm not going to go into this. You will be, you've been introduced to architecture decisions, which is essentially like a morphological matrix. But essentially, you have specific functions in the system, and there are multiple options that enable you to choose these. You're going to get much more familiar with this idea of architecture decisions in the coming weeks here in SDM and into the spring. But if you look at the combination space here, there are lots of different architectures that you could come up with. Because there are, this is in a case of farm equipment. You have communications, different kinds of communication modes. You have detection sensors, LiDAR, radar combinations, and so forth. When you combine all of those, you can have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of different combinations. Some of them won't make sense, but there are a lot of combinations there. More matrix. So generative design. As we think about being in a model-based engineering environment, one of the things that is a resource for us is a library of models, or sometimes people call it a model lake. Okay, so you have all these models of different elements of a system. And if you can stitch all of these models together into an architecture, you can potentially explore a number of different combinations, and you can explore the trade space. This is an example from Caitlin Mueller over in course two. She's an architect and designer, and is using generative design to create different forms of architecture and then evaluate them for overall efficiency and function. Okay? This is an automated process, so the generative design is driven by AI. Then you need to have those design elements integrated into the architecture itself. And so that's, you're relying on some kind of help from your computer to do that, or from programming. And then you need to do an evaluation under a number of different conditions. As you start exploring the use of these models and especially introducing AI to bring in variety and novelty. You can come up with a combinatorial space that's vast, like 10 to the 100, 10 to the 1,000 different combinations. And hopefully we'll have a guest lecture this spring talk about how you do that. But essentially, you need to not only worry about generating these concepts, but also how you filter out the bad ones so you can make this computationally tractable. But this is the direction that we're going in systems engineering. How do we harness the power of computers and AI to generate a vast number of different concepts? And then how do we handle that information? How do we reduce it to something that is usable and tractable for our purposes? I know a number of you are taking the technology road mapping class. I have some slides here, and I'm unfortunately not going to be able to cover them. But the idea here is that as you track technology trends, you will see where the technology is heading over a period of years or decades. And sometimes those changes in technologies will have enough of an impact that it affects your architecture. So this is an example here that you saw from Bruce Cameron. This one. So this is the evolution of battery technology over time. This is from the 1870s to 2050. And you can see, if you're forecasting the technology, you can see it's pretty stable on a representation. These are capacitors, ranging from maybe the turn of the 19th century, 20th century on up to the current day. And you can see that on the same scale, the capacitors are maybe gonna overtake the batteries at some point. So what does that mean for your system? And you can do this for a lot of different technologies. One of our SPM grads, Anurag Singh, did his thesis on this, then he went into a startup called TechNext, and they've applied this forecasting approach on over 150,000 technologies using patents and so forth. And so their services come to us, we'll tell you how the technology that affects you is evolving, and I can give you a sense of whether you should be afraid or you should be optimistic about where the technology is going, and by the way, this might affect your concepts. A pitch for Professor Dubek's technology road mapping class. There's a framework for looking at how road mapping, this process here, fits into your system development activities. So it should tie to your strategy, your existing capabilities, the missions, the products and services that you're offering. It will be informed by the requirements that you have, and you produce technology roadmaps. Okay, these roadmaps tell you this is a class of technology that we're interested in. And this is where we think the technology is going. The roadmaps feed into your R&D portfolio. Say, okay, here are the projects that we need to develop. This is the technology that we need to keep track of. And it could be your own internal R&D, or it could be I'm going to monitor the horizon. I look for startups, universities, wherever technology emerges. I'm going to be looking for this kind of technology. And then you infuse that into your engineering execution, architecting, and so forth, developing technologies, roadmaps, and eventually products. Okay. So I'm working with Professor Dubek and with Brian Moser and Don Rhodes and Dyke is working with us on a technology road mapping project. Look at how you use road mapping to get from strategy to your R&D portfolio. Right? How do you make better decisions about which projects to fund based on your knowledge of the way technology is evolving? Unfortunately, not enough time to talk about that in depth. Those of you who are taking the class will understand that, and if you have a chance, it's a having this be an option as well. These are just steps that you take in that road mapping process. So, let me summarize, and then it's Tom's turn to finish things up. You learn that the concept is one of the most important things you can deliver as a system architect. And it's a mapping and function to form. We've just gone through ways that you can understand how to identify more forms that map to those functions. And in the limit, you'd want to have zillions of forms that you can choose from. But there are some interim steps. You start off by understanding creativity and what constrains you from having imaginative and creative ideas about those different types of forms. And there are a few techniques that have been developed over time that allow you to have a better shot at generating more forms and therefore more architectures to evaluate. And on Wednesday, we'll talk about how you sort through what one way to explore that trade space for all these different architectures. And then as we move into the era of AI-assisted digital-based design, then the question is, how do you harness that AI power to generate, literally unimaginable numbers of different concepts, and then sort through all of those, winnow out the bad ones, and accelerate your concept development process. Okay? So with that, Tom, you're going to tell us a story from S92.
Thanks, Eric. Hopefully the mic's good now. So here's a kind of a fun example of the things that we've talked about. And this goes back to the S92 and at a time where I had just joined the program, the S92 program, but was also starting in this SDM program. And so I had left the Army stealth attack aircraft, coming on to this civil aircraft program. I was in a role where I was going to be developing all of the information that we were then going to hand off to our international partners. So we're in that phase where the definition of aircraft was coming together, but it wasn't yet ready to hand off. And so I'm coming up to speed and in this kind of new role, and given the nature of the program, this had really never been done before. It's of course you have these international partners. So I'm coming up to speed and I'm learning about various aspects of the airframe. And one of the things that's a requirement by the FAA and makes sense for civil transport is that you have a certain number of emergency exits, and you need so many for a certain number of passengers, and cockpits need exits. And we kind of knew and have experience with exits on earlier aircraft. They can be heavy, they tend to leak, maintenance is kind of annoying, a lot of adjustments and things like that. So exits as they existed at that time were not great. And so I joined the program and I'm sort of coming up to speed, I'm in cross-functional meetings and whatnot, and I'm starting to hear this kind of grumbling about the exits, and in particular, grumbling from our acoustics engineer, saying that our approach for the exits was pretty problematic. And the kind of colorful aspect of this is the guy that I had worked for previously on the expansion program, and his history at Sikorsky was he developed and added a lot of weapon systems to helicopters. So the example of adding rockets to helicopters in the war era, but turning them into the sort of weapons delivery platforms. This guy was all over that stuff. He really loved that. And he took another civil aircraft we had, added rockets to it, took it to a range
blew up a bunch of stuff and was trying to sell that civil aircraft now to international military customers. Never happened, never worked. But the main takeaway is, if you could blow something up, you know, this was kind of a good thing. So he had, in his role, he was sort of chief of design, so he was responsible for the overall configuration at that point. Had decided that it would be a good idea to have pyrotechnic exits on the aircraft. And so this is literally explosive charges. On a F-18 or even a Comanche Army aircraft, in the cockpit, a pilot wearing a helmet wants to get out of an aircraft in a crash. The aircraft could be all, you know, in a terrible state. And pyrotechnic exit, blow the windshield, blow panels, is pretty foolproof and effective. And so we had some experience with that with our Comanche aircraft. So I come on the civil program, and I'm learning that we have pyrotechnic exits on our civil aircraft. And I'm starting to, you know, think through this, like, wow, that doesn't seem like such a hot idea. And then, of course, the acoustics guy is saying, yeah, you have people that are sitting in the civil aircraft. So, like, you have one of the options is it's an airline interior, basically. So you pull the handle for the exit, and it's this explosion that goes off, potentially, you know, harming people's eardrums. And so, you know, we're starting to think, this isn't such a bad idea. And we're getting ready to deploy these designs to our partners. So I'm in this position of, okay, I got to get this right. My boss is saying explosions are good. And I'm saying, no, maybe not. And so how do you approach a situation like that, develop a new concept, and then kind of, you know, get it on the table in a way where you remain employed. So we were able to use some of these techniques. I'll show it real quick. And that allowed us to, you know, have some other ideas. And then from there, you know, we were able to work that into the design. So here's the S-92. You can see the cockpit exit, and there were two big cabin exits. And so this is sort of the form function thing, right? You know, you need an exit. It needs to be so big for this type of aircraft. So what kind of exits will work given those kind of constraints? And so here is the pew matrix that we talked about earlier. And here's an example of putting your thumb on the scale of the pew matrix. So we knew that the bulb steel was kind of the incumbent approach. And so that's the baseline that gets the zeros. And then in a pew matrix kind of approach, we said, okay, let's evaluate the pyrotechnic exit. And so what you see here is that's really cheating. You're not supposed to put minus 10 in the pew matrix table, but effectively, and this is to the question earlier, this is what it was. It was a showstopper, right? As soon as you get the FAA involved, trying to certify your aircraft, and they find out that you're setting off explosives in your cabin, it's going to be a problem, right? So we had a cross-functional group. I kept hearing about how people really like the idea of a simple push-out seal, but it's really hard for a really big exit for that kind of a seal to work. So I'll show you a picture in a second, but all the windows in the helicopter that are of this size are also exits, and there could be a little tab or something you pull, and then you're able to push that out. Some buses have similar exits. So as part of the sort of the brainstorming, like how could we get around this, we had to come up with a concept that was better than the sort of the baseline, the bulb seal, because that was heavy, and we knew that would lead in all the other things. And so as a result of this brainstorming, we came up with this new concept of we use the same type of seal in the push-out window approach, but now we're going to add something to it. We're going to add a latch to help hold it in because it's a big window or a big exit, and it can get pulled out under varying air pressure. And we'll also add a cam to it, so it makes it a little bit easier to push out. So in the lower right-hand corner of this pattern figure, you see here's a nice big handle, a cam, and in the cabin there's a similar type of mechanism. And when you crank this handle, it pushes the corner of the window out, and from there you can push the exit out with normal hand pressure. Here's a little cross-section of what a bulb seal looks like. It's very effective. It's tolerant of different dimensions and whatnot. So this became something we could offer and say, okay, boss, we think we know we need something that's going to be different than the pyrotechnics. Here's something that we think offers benefits of proper sealing and whatnot. The pyrotechnics, one of their main advantages is they don't leak because there's no opening until you fire the explosive. But here's something that works really just as well. There's very little maintenance, that sort of thing. So it ended up being a very effective solution. And I'll just wrap up by saying that this is how seriously this issue is in a helicopter, and particularly flying out to oil rigs in the North Sea. It's a terrible, harsh environment. Aircraft go down in that environment, unfortunately. And helicopters have this unfortunate tendency of being very top-heavy to flip over when you ditch into the water. So there are training centers. This one is in the northern part of the Netherlands, where it's right on the North Sea there where these oil rigs are. And they train oil rig workers to be able to get out of a helicopter that ditches. And when it flips upside down, so you're in your seat, flips upside down, you're underwater, and now you're supposed to find your exit, do it in an orderly fashion, not choke the guy next to you. So this is the kind of training. So as a reward for coming up with this new idea, my boss sent me to dunk tank training in the Netherlands, and I'm pretty sure he gave instructions to the people there to try to drown me. I was blindfolded. I don't remember any kind of Harry Houdini handcuffs or anything, but you know, it was pretty interesting. Sit in the back, you have to get out the front, you're blindfolded, and the thing flips upside down. So anyway, I didn't drown, as you can see. And but the key thing is this process and dealing with what could be, that's a bias, right, that you're dealing with in that situation. Someone's coming into a problem with a preferred approach. And so how do you work through that? And these structured approaches really help you do that because it makes it more objective. You're taking some of that emotion out of it. You know, people get kind of upset when they think their ideas, you know, being questioned. But you know, with a structured approach, and you say, "Hey, look at the attributes of this new idea, what we came up with." You can really work through that as a system engineer. And this is how this stuff is your friend, right? You can bring a lot of different perspectives together, and these structured methods. So that's my quick story. Any questions? Hopefully you don't run through this exact same situation or anything similar, but it does illustrate how it can be helpful.
We'll stick around afterward if you have any questions. We're out of time, so thank you for your participation, and we'll see you on Wednesday. We'll talk more about how we.
Thank you. little bit?
Yeah. I work from home. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to bounce here for a few weeks. Well, I think I'll be here actually for most of November. I found like an apartment that's like pretty cheap that I thought, you know, whatever. It's like half furnished, kind of don't get out of the car for now. We'll see if I can find
it. Oh, of course.
That's
really
cool. Yeah, so you'll be seeing more of me.
That's right.
See you around. Okay.
How are you?
Good, buddy. No! Joe, right?
Yeah,
there. Good to see you, buddy. I'm starting to see faces again out in the back. Remember the name.
क्या मतलब सोच सकती हूँ मेरी वजह से ये बर्फी जा रहा पानी की बर्फी एक सर्दी हो जाती है
Thank you. because of